Good evening. This is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is educator and music historian John Swed, and we're talking about his new book, Cosmic Scholar, The Life and Times of Harry Smith. John, welcome to the show. It is such a pleasure to talk to you about this book. I have to tell you, this is a really, for the audience, this is a wild biography. It must have been a real challenge for you to piece together all the diverse sources together.
Yeah. I wonder, you got to be crazy to do something like this. I mean, the idea, I don't have, you know, I'm not crazy about biographies per se. In fact, I don't think I've ever read one all the way through. Because I'm just not that interested. And also, I suspected that, you know, biographers seem to, they talk as though they know the person they're writing about as well as they know themselves. And it's just absurd the idea that you do that. So, but I was fascinated by the idea of how various people in music and the arts, how they get where they are, because they often don't, they don't come in the obvious ways. You think they, you know, some start late in life, some start early, some you know, anyway, these Sun Ra and, well, in fact, all the people I wrote about had mysteries around them, but particularly Sun Ra and Harry Smith posed enormous mysteries, and deliberately. Yeah.
For people, a lot of people have heard of Sun Ra, but Harry Smith is another story entirely.
Right.
I mean, let me list off the things that you write about in your book. He was an experimental filmmaker, an important one, a folklorist, an animator, a painter, a jazz aficionado, an anthropologist, an occultist, and that's just the beginning of the list. I mean, it's incredible. And trying to put that all together, when you're a reader reading this book, it's an incredible voyage you go on.
Yeah, and the term I used that popped into my head when I was thinking about this was the problem that why he isn't better known, one of the reasons, is that he was a jack of too many trades.
Yeah, yeah.
It's just hard to talk about. Imagine you had to write a newspaper piece about this, and I've watched people struggle with it. They pick out something they know, and they do. They spend their time on that. I did the same thing. I didn't cover the occult stuff properly. It's just too deep for me. And plus some of his other interests, minor interests as a collector. So at any rate, I treated it more like a puzzle than a biography.
And at the very start of the book, in the introduction, you're standing in the shell of a 19th century glass factory in Red Hook in Brooklyn among the boxes of Harry Everett Smith's books and records. It reminded me at the end of Citizen Kane. I mean, it was like you're surrounded by all these things.
Right.
And it was like, as you compared it to Borges' Library of Babel, I mean, it was just this vast amount of stuff with no order.
Yeah, and now that whole collection is out in Tulsa, in the Bob Dylan collection, I mean, that gets weirder yet, doesn't it?
Now, he was a legendary anthologist too, and his Anthology of American Folk Music, which is consisted of six LPs of lost commercial recordings of American folk music, is legendary for people who've never heard of it. It's an incredible feat just to have put out that.
Yeah, and I think, if I can remember my own writing, it was 10 years before anyone seemed to be paying attention to it because the thing was so expensive. I couldn't believe it till I worked out the inflation stuff. The problem was that Mo Ash, who ran Folkways, got the idea that he could record anything that the recording companies weren't recording, and the audience would be small for that, apparently, because she, you know, for several kind of reasons, but that he could keep the stuff in print forever, and it would pay for itself. So he aimed for only for schools and libraries at the beginning, and so it was around $240-$260 to have the six LPs for that. It's still kind of pricey, but not that high. So it was 10 years. In fact, it was 10 years before there was a review, which is pretty stunning.
Now, other aspects of what he did, like his studies of Native American culture and philosophy, his films. Are they all located and they're all in a safe place?
No.
I was straight lining you there, John.
Yeah, in fact, the Whitney Museum of Art has got a show coming up. What's the date? October 4th, I believe. It'll be on through January. And they've struggled for several years trying to find pieces from things. I'm not quite sure what they've got yet because I haven't seen the show. But the only place where the paintings are really available is in the Anthology of Film Archives in New York, where Harry had made a deal with him to make some films, and he gave him the paintings. And I think that's about maybe 18 paintings, but he must have done hundreds.
Wow.
And a few collectors have them, but it's not clear who the collectors were. But basically, I'd say 90% of his work is gone.
Jesus. As you write, his life was almost completely outside the public view. I mean, except for some friends or where he happened to be crashing at the moment, nobody knew what he did or who he was.
I thought of him as almost famous among the famous.
Well, he knew. The amount of people that he knew that you write about in the book is just amazing. I mean, he had rubbed elbows with an awful lot and a tremendously diverse crowd of people.
Yeah, the thing is that one of the first things I found out was he was not very social. That's to put it mildly. He often greeted people by insulting them. And he was first. Well, later on, at least, he was asking, "Did they have any money?" First, that's what.
Right.
You know, people say, "What, do you have money?" And then you know when he goes on to somebody else. And then the very first people to write about him, I think, was it Phil Elwood? Yeah, a reporter and writer for the San Francisco Chronicle. He said, for a guy who was not very social, he seemed to know everybody, which I've never figured out.
It's amazing. Now, on another point, his health was never great throughout his entire life.
Right, starting out. He had some kind of childhood disorder, which made him at least a foot shorter than everybody else and sickly. He was missing, I think he figured around, missed around 11 months of school along the way. And given a heavy drinker and doper, it's amazing he lived to be 69. I mean, I found out with various people who used a lot of drugs, it's not the drugs that killed them, it was the alcohol.
That's right.
It's true of Billie Holiday and so forth. It's certainly true of Harry.
Although, I'll tell you, those end scenes in your book, when he's close to, he returns to New York and he passes on, those were pretty harrowing about what his health was at that time.
Yeah, and as I said, using terms that people gave me, he burned people all along the way at the end. Because, I mean, you know, those who knew him as a bum. And I hedged the word bum because bums sound like people who just beg and don't do anything. But he actually was doing something with all the stuff that he was bumming. So there must be some term for that. I mean, someone said, yeah, an art mooch. this is a guy who would go without health, certainly without health care for a long time, and without proper food and drink. And yet he was putting all the money into other things he did. And the curious part to me was he could have sold things and made some money off them. I don't know how much, but he could be... he couldn't be bought, and he was doubtful about selling.
Jeez. What do we know about his childhood? That was interesting. Now, as you write in the beginning of the book, you have to be careful because he was definitely a fabulist about his own life when he was talking about it. Because he actually said at one point he might be the bastard son of Aleister Crowley. But his childhood in Washington State was really fascinating.
Yeah, he starts out as a childhood genius, and it's easy to say, but the evidence is there. He, by the age of 15, he got fascinated with American Indians, and he was living. It's hard not to know about them on the upper Northwest Coast because there's a reservation every so many miles right up the coast going into Canada. So you're exposed to that, and also with kids in school that he was involved with. But he started going up to the reservation, bicycling over, at age 15, and I just kind of imagine how that works out. A 15-year-old white kid shows up and says, "What? I'm here to find out stuff." I mean,
I know,
and
he did. I mean, he recorded stuff.
Yeah. By the way, the current ancestors of those people just can't believe they did this. Now, I do know that. I don't like to speculate but one possibility is this. The reason that they put up with him and did much more than put up with him, they gave him carte blanche to do what he wanted to, and as you say, he recorded and photographs and so forth, is that a lot of things were happening in the culture, the United States culture, and when you're 15, it would be your early 40s. No, yeah, back from the late 30s, like radio was spread everywhere at that point, which was an enormous force, and movies were reaching everybody. Bicycles were becoming cheap, which turns out to be a big thing about how kids grew up. They began to be mobile in a way they weren't before. On and on, cars were spread around. So I think one of the things that was happening with American Indians is that their own kids were drifting away from what they did. It's typical of kids of that age. And I had a colleague who, at 12 years old, was hanging out with He was on the edges of powwows in Long Island, and they noticed that he was learning the dances. And at one point, one of the leaders of the group came over and said, would he be willing to go with them when they traveled to other powwows? And the reason was their own kids didn't want to do it. So this white 12-year-old became their representative when they went to official occasions. So obviously such things could happen, as bizarre as they seem. But then Harry's case, he was using a disc cutter type recording machine, which means it's extremely heavy, and it means that you're going to make the record just as you do it, cut right through the shellac or sometimes glass base to do this thing. He also had to take car batteries with him and various kinds of transformers and the records. And I can't figure out, and nor can anyone who remembered him from the time, how he got out to this reservation, maybe 5 miles away at the time, on a bicycle. It doesn't make sense. And where did he get that recording machine from? It's very expensive.
It's amazing. His early influences are Franz Boas, Claude Lévi-Strauss. It just seems he follows his whims. Like, he starts collecting and annotating string figures. Then he becomes interested in the blues and Irish music, jazz, hillbilly music. At one point, he finally goes down the coast and arrives in Berkeley in 1945. And then he gets interested in animated films. And I actually went to YouTube and watched a couple of his films. And now he's about 27. He's influenced by Kandinsky. What was his modus operandi for making these really wild, abstract films?
Well, he'd had a long childhood history of painting and drawing. The WPA, the Works Progress Administration, was aimed at keeping people employed during the Depression, hired people to do these kind of things. And I'm almost certain that an awful lot of artists and performers and other kinds of people, their lives were changed by having these kind of people as teachers. But he had a very good teacher of drawing and painting for about, 5 or 6 years when he was a kid. And he said he had 1,000 or some drawings, which he lost. So he already knew something about painting, and he'd done some paintings of American Indian things. Only one survives of that. And I think what happened was when he got down to Berkeley, he saw, let me back up a second, only two institutions in the country were putting film on display outside of the usual theaters. I think that's safe to say. One was the Museum of Modern Art in New York, and the other was the San Francisco Museum of Art, as it was called at the time. And they found that they were getting larger audiences for their film presentations than they were for their paintings. So they were both arguing this is an art. And now Hollywood was just down the way, and most people thought weren't thinking of that as an art, as more of entertainment. But the number of painters tried to paint that's not the word I want. A number of painters tried to find a way to animate painting.
Right, right.
And their problems were how to do that and also how you're going to show it, because it's tough for galleries. And if you put them in between films, they would look like cartoons or filler or something. But so a lot of them were pretty far out people in terms of what they could do. And I have to always say, because I just discovered this myself, is that animation began at the same time as motion pictures in general, and it was far more advanced in technology. They could make anything happen. People disappear, they fly through the air, and all this, special effects were easy. So it was a real appeal, I think, to someone who painted to try to do that. Now, the problem is, how do you paint? you have to do it. It's not just drawing on the film, and he was using 35 millimeter, and some of the people were using 16, so it's really small. But in any case, 35 is still small, and you've got to repeat the same thing several times. Every picture has to be the same. And I don't know, I'm not being a person who does this sort of thing, it seems to me awfully hard to copy yourself.
Oh, I can tell you, because I've taught animation. It's incredibly tough. For him, it was 24... exposures per second. That's 1,440 in a minute. And he's painting hand-drawn images directly on a piece of film.
And both sides of the film.
Jesus, amazing.
Because he's moving back by himself. Yeah, so on one hand, it's pretty exciting, but on the other hand, it takes you forever.
That's right.
I mean, Disney was using hundreds of animators on single films.
But his idea behind doing it was to try to put, again, as you mentioned before, abstract art in motion.
Yeah, and remember, he doesn't know how to use a camera. He doesn't even have a camera. And if he had one, he couldn't afford the processing and the sound and so on. So he's working on the cheap. And this he did when he was fairly young. We're talking about, 20, 23, something like that. And he was recognized pretty fast as being one of the exceptional people. He was being shown with other people who were rather famous at the time. And then he gets the idea, because he can't afford the rights to use sound, that he would do live sound with it. But he goes further with that by saying the people could improvise. And then he starts using jazz guys to do this stuff and showing this stuff in like as it seems, showing them in jazz clubs like Jimbo's Bop City in San Francisco.
Now, originally, though, his films were unnamed, and they were meant to be silent, and it was only later that that soundtracks were added. At one point, didn't he use the Beatles?
Yeah, let's see. To start back at the beginning, he was fascinated with... He discovered peyote early on. No, that was not. No, that was later. So it was marijuana, I guess. By the way, you have to remember when talking about the 20s, the law drugs were legal. So you could buy peyote from Sears Roebuck by the bushel by the time they were doing this, well into the 50s, I think. So anyway, he had his first drug experience seeing Dizzy Gillespie. And I think also listening to Bessie Smith records, and he was getting lots of flashes of reds and colors and so forth. So he's trying to paint that onto the film, and increasingly, since he started with Dizzy, he seemed to want to do Dizzy's more complex things, which are the ones with a Latin base, and without exception, I believe, maybe there's one exception, Oh, You're Cool. They all are Latin-based. So he's got Latin and jazz rhythms going, and he's trying to represent those things visually. And this set him back to going to painting at one point, where he starts painting the record, which is to say, trying to get, by every brushstroke and touch, he's trying to get every note and chord in play. Now, this sounds absurd, and not only that, he wants to use the frame for how he does this, that is the shape of the painting and so forth, to be different for each one. So he's not just drawing a flat surface, he's doing round and straight and triangles and so on. Then it takes a great deal of time, actually sometimes years. Then he would perform the piece, that was, he would put the thing on the floor usually, stand over it with a pointer and show you where they were in the thing. Now, musicians said to me, so we could read this? I said, yeah, you could if you knew what those things meant, you could do it just like you learn notes. And I remember saying at the time that when someone said this, I said, because it wouldn't be that accurate. And the musician I was talking to said, well, whoever said that the transcriptions, hand transcriptions of improvisations were that accurate. Even Thelonious Monk made mistakes on his own writing out of his own material. So Harry's put all this stuff in motion, and running in several kinds of media. And then what struck me is at times it looked like he was trying to reinvent film, because he goes back to the earliest silent stuff and comes forward. The earliest filmmakers were magicians, so it's got that kind of quality. And then it was much later on before he ever used a camera. And even when he used the camera, it got wild. I mean, one painting that disappeared was apparently only shown once. What he did was project a film, which he had done by hand, but then behind the screen, he had other lights that were moving in various ways, so that it was lighting up the front screen in a different way. And then he filmed that. So it was a film of a film. That's pretty radical. I mean, it doesn't sound like much, but it changes the look of the film.
Well, it actually reminds me of like the light shows that went on in the late 60s and 70s at rock concerts. I mean, it sounded like that kind of a thing. He added later, much later, to some of these films. And these films have, sometimes they're just film number one, film number four. There was also the Woodsman's Dream. But later he added even the Fugs and the Beatles music to his films. And Peter Stanfill of the Fugs wrote an incredible poem called His Tapes Roll On, which is at the back of your book.
Yeah, he was encouraged to do that. He had a theory that any kind of music could go with any kind of film. And it's surprising how much that works out. And I have no idea what the theory is that would explain it. It doesn't always work. And even he admitted that, although he was trying to argue both sides of the story. And someone said, why don't you keep up to date? Now, what I hadn't understood is that when he was in New York living in the East Village, that the Beatles were huge among the Beats and the working class people there. And I found out that Worrell and other people were taken up by this. And as Ginsberg said, all these painters who wouldn't dance for anything were suddenly becoming dancers. And they wrote about it, they painted about it, and so on. So Harry got into it. Unfortunately, when you look at it on I think there are several kind of soundtracks going on YouTube, but if you see the Beatles thing, you'll see that sometimes the song is too long for the picture, or it's too short, so it'll end early or run over. So it's kind of sloppy. And but you're free to use Harry's method, which is to put anything behind that you want to and make up your own soundtrack. And people are doing that.
Well, when he was in New York in the early 50s, we're going to run out of time because as you would have to talking about Harry Smith, he was a poet. He was a visual artist. He was a Kabbalistic scholar. He got funds from the Guggenheim.
Mm-hmm. I know. Well, the real problem.
I mean, that's a whole weird story in your book in and of itself.
I estimate that it cost him at least $10,000 a year to live, but that's not much living.
No, it's not.
It's bare bones, and he was putting most of that to arts material. So that means he had to be constantly begging for things. And he seemed to get liquor and dope pretty easily. People just shared it with him, but food is something else. And for that, he was begging a lot. And I mean, I ran into people when I was, in my teens, late teens, early 20s, who would hit you up for something like, give me a quarter, man. You'd know this person. Maybe they were a veteran or something. They'd say, give me a quarter. I haven't had anything to eat. Then you find out that they've just hit 50 people up for this and they're living high.
Yeah.
Well, Harry did this sort of thing too, but he wasn't eating high. He was buying things with it.
It's amazing. We're just about out of time, and I can't recommend this book enough. It's an amazing biography. I hope it gets turned into a film because I want to see it. And if you want to see his films, please go to YouTube and look up the films of Harry Smith, because you have to really see what we are talking about. It's amazing. My guest tonight is educator and music historian John Zwed. And we've been talking about his new book, one of the most fascinating biographies I've read in a long time, Cosmic Scholar, The Life and Times of Harry Smith. John, it's been a pleasure.
Thanks a lot for having me.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name's Mark Lynch. Good night.